This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More than 29,000 people kill themselves in this country every year. Suicide is the 11th leading cause of death. There's been a great deal of research on what kinds of people decide to kill themselves and why, but new studies show that suicide can leave an emotional scar on a family that can last generations. Unlike sudden death from a heart attack, suicide is often muffled by taboo. Suicide notes have been destroyed, causes of death covered up in obituaries. Family members may not piece together what really happened until years later. Every death is hard on family and friends, but suicide can leave unresolved guilt and shame. People ask, why didn't I stop them, or how could they do this if they loved me? Sometimes, after dealing for years with a mentally ill spouse or child, a family member may even feel relief. And, of course, that itself may generate more guilt. This hour, we'll hear about new research and from a New York Times writer whose father committed suicide. Biographer Diane Middlebrook will talk about how the suicide of Sylvia Plath affected the creative life of her husband, plus what we know about the last thoughts of people who survived suicide jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge. Our number here in Washington, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Erica Good joins us now. She writes about human behavior for the New York Times and recently wrote about her own father's suicide for the October 28th edition. She joins us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the day you found out about your father's death. You were, what, 7 years old at the time?
I was 7 years old. I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was scheduled to go to a horse show that afternoon. I woke up in the morning. I heard my father leaving the house. I called out to him. He came in and said goodbye to me. Later that morning, the telephone rang, and my memories really of the rest of that day are pretty hazy. My mother was terribly upset. She sent me and my sister to the horse show I was supposed to go to and gave my sister strict orders not to talk about what had happened. The next 2 days later, it was October, I guess the next evening, because it was October 30th, 1960, I went trick-or-treating. A lot of relatives descended on the house, and then they all left again.
Now, this was you actually didn't know what had happened for many years, but in fact, you write in this story that you intuitively felt something was wrong.
I knew that there were unexplained questions, that something, people would ask me how my father died. I would say a car accident, which is indeed how he died. And I knew somehow that that wasn't the complete answer. It was not until several decades later, really in my late 20s, when my mother finally was willing to answer questions about his death, that I discovered that, in fact, he had taken his own life.
He'd left a note, and what did it say?
I don't know. My mother destroyed it immediately, and she did not remember what it said. She had blocked it out, or for whatever reason, she couldn't recall it.
Now, under those circumstances where in your immediate family, I guess your mother was the only one who knew what had actually happened, what were the immediate effects in your family?
Well, I think for me, I think it was most difficult for my mother because she had this enormous secret that she kept from people. You know, it was a very different time. It was a time when people didn't talk about mental illness. They didn't talk about depression. They certainly didn't talk about suicide. I think that in many ways, my father tried to be very considerate. He took our older car, which was a light blue Buick, 1956 Buick. He left my mother the newer car, a shiny brown Oldsmobile. He managed to find a way to do this so that she would not find his body. I think he was quite aware that her own father had committed suicide, and I think he must have been concerned about finding some method of doing this that would not leave his family with that particular legacy of finding his body. Mm-hmm. I think he was concerned about insurance issues. And so I think that he actually tried to take this step in the most considerate way he could.
If there is a considerate way to do that. One of the fascinating things that you write about is even though you didn't really know what was going on, you had problems with anger, unresolved anger.
Yes. My mother clearly had a lot of very strong and mixed emotions that went on for quite a long time. I think it took her a very long time to actually start grieving his death in any kind of, I don't hesitate to say normal, but in a way that could resolve things for her. She got actually quite angry at him very late when she was in her 80s. Hmm. But until that time, she felt that this was really something that even when she talked about it to me and to my sister, that this was something that should be kept totally within the family. And she would get quite upset if she heard that I had spoken about it casually or that I had, you know, talked to a friend about it or something like that.
Once she told you, it explained what had actually happened. I mean, was there sort of a aha? I mean, did it click? Now I get it?
Yes, I think it didn't come as a surprise to me because I think that some part of me had always suspected it. Since I've written this article, I've heard from many people who have had similar experiences in their own lives, and many of them talk about situations in which their parents committed suicide or a relative committed suicide and they were not told that it was a suicide. In one case, woman wrote to me who was about the same age as I was when her father committed suicide, and her mother didn't even tell her that her father was dead, but just said that he was ill and had to go away. One of the findings, I think, that was interesting to me in the studies that I looked at was a study by Dr. Julie Sorrell at the University of Rochester, which found that children whose parents have committed suicide have more difficulty accepting the death. And I remember very clearly standing in a parking lot. I must have been 8 or 9, standing with my mother and crying hysterically and insisting that my father was still alive. I mean, it must have been horrible for my mother. But I had a very difficult time even accepting that he, you know, was not there anymore.
Joining us now is Dr. Herbert Hendon. He is a psychiatrist and the medical director at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He is also with us from our bureau in New York. And thank you for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Why have survivors like Erica Good, why have people like that been neglected by research in the past, do you think?
Well, I think that survivors themselves kept their stories to themselves and didn't project themselves as needing help. The researchers had contact with survivors back in the 50s because they decided that they would learn about suicide from interviewing survivors about what happened in their families. And there were 2 or 3 major studies over the next few decades where every suicide in a city was examined by interviewing the families. But the families that were interviewed didn't say, you know, we have problems too. The researchers were interested in learning about why the suicide. Suicide was the more obvious dramatic tragedy, and survivors were a source of information. It was much later, probably more toward the 80s, that it was, and I think partially it had to do with the fact that there was a dramatic increase between mid-50s and early 80s in youth suicide. And so many young people, and the increase in youth suicide was threefold increase, it was hard to keep that quiet. And survivors began talking about it, they couldn't keep it quiet, and researchers became more interested in it. And still, the interest was mainly in what survivors could tell them. That began to change. We do a project at our foundation where therapists are the survivors because they have some of the same reactions that Erica described and you described in the beginning that survivors generally have. And we were also interested in what we could learn about suicide, but the therapist said they wanted to talk about what they experienced and what their trauma was, and they literally obliged us to add a component to it to look at them. Hmm. And in fact, we kind of know more about survivors through therapists than we do otherwise, because we are able to study them more systematically.
Are these therapists who had a family member or a friend who killed themselves?
No.
Or are these therapists who had a patient kill themselves?
The patient had a patient who killed himself, but had some of the same reactions, the same guilt, the same struggling with it, and that survivors have generally. And they permit us to look at one dimension that's missing in the research with regard to survivors. What we don't know is why some survivors are so terribly more distressed than others. There are some who are paralyzed by it, and others who are not. And with the therapists, it's the same way. There's a small everybody is traumatically affected by it. So there's no such a thing that you come home scot-free from this. But some are terribly traumatized by it. And we found with the therapists that it's very much a function of what went on between the person that the patient that died and the therapist, and that's what's missing in our understanding of why some survivors become unable to function or terribly traumatized, is that it certainly has something to do with how they saw the relationship before the person died, and that's probably the most unexplored area of research with survivors.
We want to hear from you as well. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. We're going to start with an email that we got from Liz Risden. Over a long period of time, she writes, 4 of my mother's siblings committed suicide. We survivors have been marked and changed by this and have taken steps to prevent the occurrence in future generations. Now it is 20 years after the last suicide. We survivors have guarded optimism as no one else has killed him or herself. However, it will be a very long time before we and our descendants feel truly comfortable with the idea that we have changed our family fate. That's interesting. Does suicide run in families, Dr. Hendon?
Yes, there is clear evidence of a genetic factor in suicide. For a long time, we thought that what was inherited was the predisposition to depression, but there's been evidence now that that's inherited, but there's something else, and some families will have depression and not suicide, and others will have both. Mm. And there is clearly a genetic factor in suicide. We're not 100% sure what that is, but that it runs in families is without any doubt.
Let's get a caller in. This is Melanie from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm taking my call.
Sure.
My grandfather committed suicide back in 1979, and I was only 8 years old, but it wasn't hidden, and I felt really grateful to my family for not hiding it, even though I was really young. And so I had an easier time, you know, assimilating the fact. But then recently, actually, 97, my uncle took his life. But before he did, he took the lives of his 3 young daughters.
Oh.
And so we had some, you know, grief therapy and counseling, just a, you know, minor amount, all of the family that was left. And they did say that there was some kind of a connection between, you know, the genetic factor, but also just in, like, people in the same family, there's a tendency for people to commit suicide because others in their family have used that as a coping mechanism. So for whatever reason, they consider that a a viable option to a problem or perceived problem.
Melanie, let me begin by saying how terribly sorry we are for your loss. I mean, that's an awful thing to have to face.
Yeah, it's surreal, but yeah.
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 Is there a... Well, we don't have time enough left in this segment for a question to Dr. Hendon, but when we come back, we'll ask him whether one suicide sort of lowers the social or psychological barriers to other members of a family, and they may consider the same thing. Melanie, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. When we come back from a break, we're going to continue our conversation about the effects of suicide on family and friends who are left behind, and new research into how they are affected, both in the immediate and in the long term. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255 or email TOTN@NPR.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the lingering effects that a suicide can have on family and friends, effects that can last generations. Our guests are Erica Good, a science writer for the New York Times, and Dr. Herbert Hendon. He's a director of the America Foundation of Suicide Prevention. Both of them are our bureau in New York. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Dr. Hendon, just before the break, Melanie called, and that's an interesting question about one suicide in a family. Does it seem to lower some sort of barrier for other members of the family?
One would assume so. However, in the caller's story, 20 years had gone by, and it seems that they managed pretty well. So one of the points Erica made in her article, as I recall, was that it's hard to evaluate how much is the genetic and how much is the influence of coming up in a family where suicide is there. In this particular case, it didn't. It sounded like they coped reasonably well with it, and this was 20 years later and an uncle where it would happen. The other thing I would comment on in the story, and it touches on something Erica said also, is that what you often see with young children who are not told, and the caller makes the point that it helped her. I saw a woman who didn't tell her 8 and 10-year-old boys that it was a suicide for 2 years. I had advised her to tell them. I was seeing her in connection with a suit she had against the company that her husband had worked for. But when I saw her a second time, a year and a half later, she had just told her 2 children that their father had been a suicide, and they told her they were so relieved that she finally told them because they'd been walking around on tiptoes trying to act like they didn't know it was a suicide because they felt that it would be disturbing to her. So the protective instinct that the person had not to tell actually gave her 2 children much more difficulty than having told. So I was interested to hear the caller make the point that she felt it had been helpful to her. Because that's the experience of most of us in the field.
Erica, when you eventually found out as an adult what had actually happened with your father, you're a reporter. You acted like a reporter. You went to try to find out why.
I did. A number of years ago, and I think this was something I sort of started doing earlier on when I would meet someone who had known my father, I would ask a lot of questions. At one point, I went on a very determined search. My father was quite a prominent scientist. And I went and found people who had worked with him. I got copies of the police report from the car accident. I got copies of the autopsy report. I tried to find the people on the report who were listed as witnesses to the crash. And it was, I think, something that I had to do, and at the same time, it was enormously unsatisfying because it turned out that, you know, this was the 50s and these were guys, and, you know, they didn't talk to each other about, you know, these friends of my father's and his coworkers. They didn't talk about their internal lives, about what they were feeling, whether they were depressed, what was going on in their families. So they told, you know, they were able to tell me about what he was like as a teacher, what he was like as a friend, but really knew very little about what was going on with him inside his head.
They didn't know why.
They didn't know why. My mother, I think, didn't know why, really. I think she speculated for a long time, and I know she felt an enormous amount of guilt, but she would sometimes put forward theories for what might have happened, but, you know, they will remain forever theories. We really don't and will never know. Documents that I got, you know, they had little facts that I hadn't known, but they didn't have the answer.
Let's get another caller on the line. Jamie joins us from Medford, Oregon.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Mr. Cohen. I would like to say to Ms. Good, who's there, probably there with you right now.
She's in our New York bureau, but she's with us.
All right. Well, I'd just like to say to her, as a person who has tried to commit suicide several times during the late 80s and early 90s, don't feel confused or saddened because of what your father did, because basically he probably felt too much ashamed to tell you, which is the way I felt when I was doing it.
It wasn't about her. In other words, Jamie, it was about him.
Yeah, Well, yes, I think so. I'm speaking for myself because I wouldn't have told my family I was going to kill myself, for goodness sakes. Personally speaking, I think there is kind of a genetic connection because my father's mother suffered from deep depression and was sent to a mental hospital and had electroconvulsive therapy to the point where she didn't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Maybe I should ask a question of the. Is there a psychiatrist that you're interviewing as well?
Dr. Hendon is the director of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
What does he think about the genetic link between suicides, and does it actually skip generations? Because my father, he doesn't have any symptoms of this, but I seem to have gotten everything that his mother had.
Yeah.
Yeah, and kind of affected his life, but not to the point where he was, like, depressed or anything like that.
Dr. Hendon?
We know there's a genetic link. Sometimes it skips generations, but very often it doesn't. I saw last year a woman whose husband had taken out an insurance policy. He was depressed that required that 2 years elapse before you could collect if you kill yourself, and one day after the 2 years he did it. And she was in to see me because this was now 5 years later, and her 22-year-old son had done exactly the same thing, took out an insurance policy, waited 2 years, and then killed himself. So clearly there was no skipping of generations. It was also contrary to the idea that every suicide is impulsive. These suicides were not impulsive. And for that matter, I didn't think your father's suicide sounded impulsive in the sense that he was an impulsive person. In the sense that's often described for suicide. Some people are, but not all are.
May I add something, Neil?
Sure.
You know, I think it's important also to say that the fact that you have one or more suicides in your family is not destiny, as one researcher put it. In fact, you know, I think for me at least, over time, it gives you a chance to really find out who you are and whether you do have the propensity for this and to change. It can be an impetus for change in your own life to make sure that your life goes in a different direction from that.
Dr. Hendon, I wonder, is there any difference if someone commits suicide at the end or near the end of a long illness, something like that, a cancer victim, somebody like that. Is that different from someone who, like Erica Good's father, who drove his car into the abutment of a bridge?
Well, I think that our experience has been that all death, where the person is dying gradually and slowly, kind of prepares you for the death. So that to some degree, that's not just true for suicide, I know that my father died slowly, and my grieving took place before he died.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's true for many people, so that there is a difference. There's something about the shock that's very different, and that's true whether it's an accident or a homicide as well as suicide. You're not prepared for it.
There's just the added layer when it's suicide.
Yes.
Okay, let's get Melissa on the line. She's with us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask a question, I guess, of everybody there now. People who are the closest person to the person who commits suicide, whether it be a wife or a fiancé, in my case, or whoever's the most responsible person, I want to ask them about the loneliness that's left after the person dies. It's all at once you lose that individual, who is, of course, the closest mm-hmm. person that you have. And at the same time, there's a feeling that others in some way blame you because, after all, you were the one who should have known. And it's not just your own feelings, but, say, other family members of that individual who may look at you and say, why didn't you know? Why didn't you do something?
Yeah. How long has it been for you, Melissa?
6 years.
And obviously still tender subject.
I'm sorry?
And obviously still a tender subject.
It never really goes away.
Dr. Hendon?
Well, the pain that Melissa talks about is completely understandable. It is complicated if there's a feeling that you are being blamed. That's not true in every case, but if you feel, And most of the time, the blame has nothing to do with anything than somebody looking to blame somebody for something they don't understand. Or they may even feel troubled themselves and blame somebody else. That's even true for the therapists that we see, not for the average person. If a family member blames them, even if they've done nothing wrong, they tend to feel guilty and more disturbed than otherwise. So I think the loneliness and pain would be there in any case, but I think it gets complicated if you've had the experience that anybody or somebody else thinks it's somehow, in some way, your fault.
Erica, it was obviously your father who died. You were 7 years old. You wrote that what you lost then was the smell, the idea of that presence in the house.
Yes, I think, my sister was 16. She was a senior in high school. I really didn't have an opportunity to know my father as, an adolescent knows a parent, which is as a much fuller person, a person who you have discussions with and you admire, not only because they're this, large, parental figure who picks you up and, twirls you around, but because you admire their opinions or the way they think or other aspects, that you don't really appreciate about your parents till you're older. So for me, it was really just the sense that my entire world had completely turned upside down, something that I think happens with anyone who loses a parent when they're small, and then complicated on top of that by this layer of these incredibly complex emotions that my mother had and had difficulty.
The loneliness that Melissa's talking about would certainly have been one of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And all of the changes that come with that.
Melissa, thanks very much for the call, and hang in there, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go to Patty, and Patty's with us from Bend, Oregon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Suicide has sort of swirled around my entire life, and as a young child, my grandfather committed suicide. Well, we're not sure. It's one of those, but he was playing with a loaded gun, and he shot himself, whether it was his ineptitude with the gun or did he, in fact, commit suicide. So that was my first blush with it. And then as a young person, totally overwhelmed with life, I attempted suicide and woke up. I was saved and woke up and remembered the embarrassment of not having succeeded. And then I had to deal with all of those feelings. Then I became a therapist, and one client who was, very happy, healthy, we planned to see her fiancé who was in jail, and I got a call the next day that she was dead from an overdose. Was it a suicide? And then another woman who was determined to commit suicide, and she did. And we all knew that she was determined. We tried to block her in many ways. And that was one of those things, to see the determination. In my most recent experience with this, I assisted the death of my terminally ill daughter. Now, was Jody's death a suicide? Hello?
Yes.
Oh, good. Was her death a suicide? It really bothers me, and it bothered Jody to the extent that she made me promise. I stood beside her bed, and I crossed my heart and raised my right hand and pledged to her that I would work for the rights of the terminally ill. And in so doing, really work very hard to clarify that a person who has been diagnosed terminally ill does not commit suicide, that there's a distinction between a suicide and the death of a terminally ill person.
Well, Dr. Hendon, you spoke earlier about that there was a distinction, particularly with people who've been having a long illness. Yet there's another aspect of this, and I don't mean to get away from what Patty was talking about, but there's another aspect of this that you write about that, sometimes in after the death of someone in a long illness or someone in the suicide of someone who's been struggling with depression for a long time, people can feel a degree of relief.
Yes, they feel a degree of relief, and there's a mixture of feelings about the relief. They don't feel entitled to feel the relief, and the same thing is true for the anger that people feel. No matter it's very usual that you're going to be angry for being left the way Melissa was left by somebody, or even worse, if you have young children and your husband kills yourself. But people then struggle with the fact, have they a right to feel that anger? Because after all, the other person must have been suffering terribly. Nevertheless, they left you where you were in life in a very disturbed situation, and it's impossible not to feel angry. And that's one of the problems that perhaps I didn't touch on earlier, that's very much a complicating factor for survivors. The anger is inevitable, is natural, and it's harder to cope with because you somehow don't feel you're entitled to it.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And I wanted to get to an email that we got from Pat. She writes, or he writes, I'm not sure, could you comment on the feelings of guilt and anger surrounding the suicide of an abusive parent? My father killed himself when I was 26. He was an alcoholic, a molester, and verbally abusive to me growing up. Part of the anger that I still have is knowing that there will never be any resolution for me. I'll never be able to confront him. I also feel conflicted and guilty that I'm speaking ill of the dead. So, Dr. Hendon, can you want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think he's explained it in the way he described it. I mean, it's inevitable that degree of complicated feelings. In actuality, what we see generally is that when somebody is terribly troubled, that's not the same as if you were to have an abusive parent. But if you're dealing, let's say, with a child of 21 or 22 who's mentally ill for years and kills themselves, parents usually find it a little easier to accept because they're kind of prepared for it. Very, very, very often they don't have a clue that their child is feeling what he is. They may find it out from a diary he left afterwards while they thought nothing was wrong. The boy that I mentioned who took out the insurance policy, his mother had no idea till she saw a diary which indicated he'd been depressed for the 2 years and keeping it in a diary. So that it's a variety of things. I think you're going to still feel troubled that you never were able to resolve things with an abusive parent. But in some ways, it's a different kind of pain than if you lost somebody that was kind to you and loved you. And it's not possible to say which situation is better or worse. They're both awful.
We just have about 45 seconds left with you, and it's far too short for this question. But if you grew up in a family where there has been suicide, what can you do to prevent it from happening again?
Well, I think Erica touched on that. In addition, I would reinforce what she said about it not being a destiny, because the circumstances of your life, we don't know to what degree, can protect you from it. So that if you're in a situation where you have good relationships with other people, the chances are that that's a protective factor, even with people who have inherited predispositions to things. And there's also your own sense of what you can do to make your life work, which Erica touched on, and which I would agree. It's not destined to happen by any means.
Dr. Hendon, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Herbert Hendon is a psychiatrist and medical director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He was with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our discussion of suicide and its effects on the people left behind. Erica Good will be with us. We'll also be talking with the biographer of Sylvia Plath about the effect of her suicide on the work of her husband. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're discussing how families cope after the death of a family member from suicide. Our guest is Erica Good, a science writer for the New York Times. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Erica Good is the author of an article that appeared in the New York Times on October 28th called And Still, Echoes of a Death Long Past. It tells the story of her discovery many years after the fact of the suicide of her father when she was 7 years old. And Erica, I wanted to ask you, some survivors develop almost kind of an obsession. I'm not sure if that might not be too strong a word, but an obsession with suicide. Did you?
I don't think that's too strong a word. I don't think it applies to everyone who is bereaved by a suicide, but I went through a period certainly in adolescence and probably into my early 20s where I became obsessed with finding out about, for example, poets, Sylvia Plath. Mm-hmm. I read all of Sylvia Plath's work. I read everything I could find about her. She had lost her father when she was a small child also. I identified with her in some way. And in some way, I think I was trying out that identity. Was that me? Was that something that, you know, it also was a time when I think unhappy teenagers were drawn to kind of this mythology of self-destruction where, you know, that it still exists in some forms and certainly later came up again with Kurt Cobain and other popular figures.
Elliot Smith, yeah.
Yeah, and Elliot Smith.
Yeah. Speaking of Sylvia Plath, though, joining us now is Diane Middlebrook. She's the author of a biography of the poet Anne Sexton and most recently of the book called Her Husband, Hughes and Plath, A Marriage. It's the story of poets Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, and it tells the story of their creative and emotional partnership. Diane Middlebrook joins us. She's also in our bureau in New York. It's nice of you to be with us today.
Nice of you to invite me.
You write in Her Husband that depression killed Sylvia Plath, but for many years, a lot of feminists blamed her husband, Ted Hughes. Why in suicide is there a need to assign blame?
Well, my work as a biographer doesn't really generalize that way. I focus down in on the excruciating particulars of the death and the family context. And in Her Husband, I'm looking at it through the survivor, the life of the survivor and the work of the survivor, Ted Hughes. Mm-hmm. I think there's a natural tendency to look for the culprit when there's a suicide. Somebody has to be to blame. That was discussed in the earlier part of this hour. So I was looking for, with the question, what happened to Ted Hughes when Sylvia Plath killed herself? And there's plenty of evidence that he went through just an agony of self-reproach and deep, deep remorse, and that the struggle for him was first to, what he put it into beautiful words in a letter to someone, he said he had to work his way out of the dilemma of pain and the psychological inferno into which he had plunged his children. This was many years after Plath's death, actually, the aftermath of attempting to raise the children. He went through a second episode of a woman close to him who had borne a child with him, committed suicide too. That happened in 69, 6 years after Plath's death. And for many years, about four or five, Hughes was absolutely brought to a psychological and creative halt by this. And it wasn't until he began to approach the problem of her death through his creativity that things began to integrate for him. And I was very struck with Erica's comments about her investigation of her father's death. That seems to me to be a good example of the way that the mystery of the suicide and the dilemma of pain can prompt one to master techniques of discovery and expression. That is, it can be a very strong stimulus to creativity in a creative person, as it was with Hughes.
So Erica Good, as we mentioned, acted like a reporter and reported her father's death. Ted Hughes was a poet.
He was a poet.
He dealt with it in his poetry.
Yes, and interestingly, he tried to write elegies for Sylvia Plath right away, and it wasn't until about at least 10 years after her death, that he began to pull her back into life for him. And he did this in the course of editing her journals, her liveliness, the way she came back to life for him, literally, in her words, in her journals, was an inspiration to him. He says about the writing of birthday letters, which he wrote very, very privately, did not intend to publish them. He said he wrote them as letters addressed privately to her whenever he wanted to summon her to his side and feel her there listening to him. And in the course of writing those letters, he recreates the circumstances of their creative partnership, and he also affirms its continuation in his own life right up until the time of his death.
Erica, in your article, and you were talking about it just in a way a minute ago, when you were reading Sylvia Plath and those things, you wrote about the great attraction the seductiveness, really, that suicide can have. It can appear to be a romantic subject.
You know, one researcher that I was talking to who has spent a lot of time thinking about the state of mind of someone in the period before they kill themselves, described it as a siren song, where you literally have to, Yeah, the person feels almost like they have to tie themselves to the mast to keep themselves from being pulled towards death in that way. It becomes, there is almost a point, a tipping point, where the person is rushing headlong towards it, and it takes some sort of major shift to get them to divert them from that path. And I think that that also helped me understand my father's, you know, whatever he may have been going through, clearly wasn't about me. It was, you know, he had gotten to a place where, you know, this became the only solution, and there was an enormous pull to it.
Diane Middlebrook, in your earlier book about Anne Sexton, I think you wrote that at one point she wanted to commit suicide because she thought it would define her as an icon.
No, that's not quite right. Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton were pals. They drank together at the Ritz Bar. Sexton wrote a little memoir about Plath that said they used to do this after their course with Robert Lowell and talk about their suicide attempts as addicts speak to each other. Ah. Sexton wrote a wonderful poem called Wanting to Die, trying to explain to us outsiders what it's like to be inside the desire to die, to kill yourself. And the great lines were, like carpenters, they never ask quite why build, they only ask which tools. But Sexton was a person who used suicide attempts as a way to draw a halt to episodes of when the cycle would start up again and she would feel herself going into a deep depression. A suicide attempt was a way to call it to a halt, an expensive way. Admittedly, she attempted suicide 9 times before she killed herself.
Dangerous way, too, yeah.
Yes, and it's an entirely different family situation, and I would say even narrative, actually, in Anne Sexton's life.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Diane Middlebrook wrote a biography of the poet Anne Sexton. Her most recent book, Her Husband, Hughes and Plath, A Marriage. She joined us from our bureau in New York. And Erica Good, we wanted to thank you for hanging in throughout the program today.
Thank you.
Erica Good is a science writer for the New York Times. She was also with us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.